corporal punishment should not be outlawed. That if a school felt that it was an appropriate discipline to the principal, it was allowed.
Is that still your view?
Yes, sir.
Palin's pick for lieutenant governor faces tough questioning. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 20th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the case for allowing visitors to tour a fragile ecosystem near Sitka.
It is opening up a can of worms, in a sense, to say we are going to start bringing people out to the island.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
The State House Judiciary Committee held a hearing in Fairbanks today on the man chosen by Governor Sarah Palin to be the state's next lieutenant governor. Army National Guard Major Craig Campbell has served as commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs for the last 6.5 years. Campbell will be leaving behind a 35-year military career if he's confirmed to be the next lieutenant governor, and his responsibilities will be different, mainly overseeing elections. House member Woody Salmon, who represents a large rural district, queried Campbell about the voting system, which still relies on the mail in some villages.
Earlier you said that you're from the dinosaur age, you know, you're hard to change and stuff like that. Would it be possible to improve some of the election results and the way they vote in the rural areas?
Campbell responded by saying he's gone from a pager to a cell phone to a BlackBerry and believes technology will be part of the solution.
I don't have the answer. But I do believe that, and do agree with you, that we have to do things a little differently. To accept the fact that you have delayed responses out of rural Alaska and that decisions made are well past the date of the election because of the old system of doing elections is not an acceptable answer.
Campbell said he's been friends with Sean Parnell for a long time, and the two share the same agenda of smaller government, economic development, and minimal taxation. Previous to his state job, Campbell served many years on the Anchorage Assembly. Judicial Committee member Representative Max Grunberg of Anchorage had done his homework and probed Campbell about past advocacy for everything from privatization of utilities and charity care for inebriates to higher library fees and even corporal punishment.
Is it still your view that corporal punishment should be permitted in preschools?
Through the chair, to Representative Grunberg, you're reading the press again. You said preschools. I advocated that corporal punishment should not
I'm sorry, daycare.
I did not say that either. I maintained it in the assembly that corporal punishment should not be outlawed, that if a school felt that it was an appropriate discipline principle, it was allowed.
Is that still your view?
Yes, sir.
There was also some critical input from the few members of the public who testified. The toughest came from retired Air Force Colonel and former Air National Guard pilot Troy Dunn, who testified about Campbell's failure to punish Air Guard commanders found guilty of fraud, waste, and abuse for personal use of military aircraft.
I contacted the investigating officer at the Pentagon and was told that the report and its results were forwarded to the Alaska Adjutant General, Major General Craig Campbell for action, and they have received no reply as to what action he would take.
The meeting closed with no response from Campbell to the allegations, but Judicial Committee Chairman Jay Ramris said he wasn't swayed and would support Campbell. The Senate has scheduled a confirmation hearing the day the legislature votes on Campbell's confirmation in special session, August 10th in Anchorage. Governor Palin is touring the state in her final days in office. In the last few weeks, she's visited Kotzebue and Fairbanks to sign legislative bills. And on Friday, she was in Unalakleet to sign an expansion of the Power Cost Equalization Program into law. On her way to the airport later, she said she wasn't on a farewell tour.
Well, no, because I am Alaskan. I've grown up here, and I'm going to remain in an Alaskan. So it's not farewell. It's just, thanks for letting me be here, Unalakleet, and I'll see you soon.
Palin followers have kept a close eye on the messages she's been sending lately from her Twitter account. Last week, she wrote, 10 days till less politically correct Twitters fly from my fingertips outside state sight. She explained the comment in Unalakleet.
Because obviously I have to restrain myself and be very politically correct in state tweeting on a state site, but right. Once... Sarah Palin, Alaskan. I can really call it like I see it.
Palin will reside in a ceremony in Fairbanks on Sunday. A soldier based with Fort Richardson in Anchorage is being held captive by the Taliban in Afghanistan. Private Bo Bergdahl is a 23-year-old from Haley, Idaho. A video shown on the internet shows him eating and saying he fears never going home again. The town of Haley is in the national spotlight today, and a local coffee house has become the Central Idaho community's portal to the world. Northwest News Network correspondent Doug Nagvornik reports.
When word of Bo Bergdahl's capture was confirmed, Sue Martin agreed to serve as Haley's go-to clearinghouse. The owner of Zaney's River Street Coffee House, where Bergdahl once worked as a barista, is taking reporters' calls. She's also trying to find room for all of the flowers sent to Bergdahl's family. Martin says after weeks of secrecy about Bergdahl's situation, Haley residents are happy to finally be able to talk about it.
An amazing community, and everybody just wants to know what can they do. And now there's some satisfaction that they can do something.
People from around the world are also expressing their support for Bergdahl on Zaney's Facebook page. Beyond the coffee house, Idaho Governor Butch Otter, local and military officials say they're keeping quiet out of respect for the Bergdahls. The family has issued a statement thanking people for their support and asking for privacy. I'm Doug Nadvornik reporting.
Smoke advisories are still in effect for travelers driving the Edgerton Highway to McCarthy due to the Chaquina fire within the Wrangell St. Elias National Park. Fire Information Officer Kathleen Cavlock says the fire is still on the south side of the Chittenah River, away from historical structures, but it is spreading to the west.
It is now estimated at nearly 30,000 acres. They did attempt an aerial backburn. It was not successful. The fire continued north. It was northwest. It's about 3/4 of a mile from the river. They did bring in 2 more helicopters. So now we have a total of 4 helicopters with bucket abilities on the fire. They're bringing in a strike team of engines, which will be 6 engines, and they will help with structure protection and preparing houses for defensible space.
Winds last night helped to push the fire backwards, easing fears that the fire could jump the river. Efforts to douse the fire's western perimeter with water carried in by helicopters are ongoing, but are only slowing the fire's progress toward the confluence of the Nizina and Chittenah rivers. Cavlock says McCarthy is in no danger at this time, and some light rain Sunday night helped to reduce the fire's heat. The state and the National Park Service are coordinating firefighting efforts on that fire. Meanwhile, the Minto Flats South Fire is holding on to its place as largest fire in the state at more than 210,000 acres. The fire is part of the Rail Belt complex of fires. Gary Lunhausen is a spokesman for the Alaska Division of Forestry.
And because it has the potential to do what it wants to do, basically, all the structures in the vicinity of the Minto Flats South Fire are technically threatened. Of course, we're going to do all we can to keep the fire away from those structures. Recently, there has been significant movement on the southern flank of the fire, and there's one particular structure where we have 8 smoke jumpers on the ground right now, and yesterday they had to burn out around that cabin to protect that cabin, and I think by now, or at least by the end of the day, the fire will have burned completely around that structure.
He says the fire probably will burn until the snow flies. Crews are being taken off the Shanta Creek fire on the Kenai Peninsula after light rains covered the fire area. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, dip netters flock to the Kenai River.
You know, yesterday was my first time. Stick the net in the water and you'll get lucky. That's about it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
100 years ago, Teddy Roosevelt set aside St. Lazaria Island in the Sitka Sound as a wildlife refuge. Today, the island is the nesting site for more than 500,000 seabirds. To celebrate its centennial, local agencies teamed up to lead the first ever public walking tour of the island. Last month, 24 birdwatchers and nature buffs embarked on a rare adventure, one that may signal an opening of the island to public visitation. KCAW's Shalice Haas reports.
86-year-old Chuck Johnstone finds his balance in the swaying Zodiac before stepping off onto craggy black rocks, slick with seaweed. He takes his wife's hand, and together they pick a path under a cloudy sky spotted with glaucous winged gulls and oyster catchers.
It's been so long since I've been here that it's like coming home.
The Johnstones have come to this remnant of an ancient volcano to get a close-up look at something few others have seen, the nesting seabirds of St. Lazaria Island. Most of the people on this tour have never been on the island, but this is the third trip for Chuck and Alice Johnstone, longtime residents of Sitka. Alice Johnstone remembers their last visit to the island early in the spring. She thought they'd timed their trip to avoid the fragile nesting season, but there were already birds in the burrows.
And it was distressing to step on the burrows and things would squeak underneath our feet. So we decided we'd never come back again. So here we are.
Underground at St. Lazaria, more than 250,000 pairs of storm petrels make their nests. A casual stroll could devastate chicks and eggs hidden in the earth. And while there's no formal prohibition against visiting the island, it is discouraged. But this time, the Johnstones have come on a formal tour, the first of its kind, organized by the Sitka Conservation Society and the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge.
The flying footballs, as we like to call them, are the tufted puffins, and we call them the flying football because they tend to flap their wings really fast and look like they can't really fly at all.
20-year-old Danette Perez is a research intern working on St. Lazaria this summer. In her assumed role as tour guide, Perez leads a small group of visitors through shoulder-high salmonberry bushes to a clearing where dozens of pin flags stick out from the soft earth. Perez kneels down next to an orange flag and pulls out something small, gray, and fluffy.
Okay, so here we have a fork-tailed petrel chick. They are very little, very sensitive, so I'm going to put him back so he doesn't get too starved.
She explains that the parents fly long distances to gather food and sometimes leave the chicks alone for days at a time. To conserve their energy, they go into a deep sleep where their body temperature drops and their heart rate slows.
So sometimes you'll get a chick that'll be really small, and then the next time you check it, and it's this huge, big, tubby thing, like it's been sitting around with a can of Edie's ice cream just sitting there the whole time, because they have to load up, and then they just burn it all off for a couple days until the parents can get back.
In addition to the birds that make their nests underground, this 65-acre island is also home to tufted puffins, thick-billed murres, and pelagic cormorants, a seabird species that makes its nest in the island's steep cliffs. All of that makes St. Lazaria a bird scientist's dream. Since 1994, the island has been the site of a seabird monitoring project run by the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. Leslie Slater is the lead research biologist.
We're using seabirds as a way to tell us what's happening in the marine ecosystem in terms of its health and overall changes. And it's somewhat indirect, but because seabirds are top predators, they are pretty reflective of what's happening in the ocean in a more immediate sense.
But the data gathered on St. Lazaria is only a small part of a much larger picture. The refuge has 10 monitoring stations that cover more than 3,000 miles from Sitka Sound to the Chukchi Sea and contribute to data that tracks nearly 40 million birds.
And we're learning some very important things by having multiple islands where we monitor. Without St. Lazaria as one very important piece of that scientific puzzle of all this monitoring going on the coast, you would be losing a piece of that story.
That's Lisa Matlock, an education specialist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the agency that manages the refuge. She says while research is part of her agency's mandate at St. Lazaria, she also believes it's time to open the island to a small number of visitors.
It is opening up a can of worms, in a sense, to say we are going to start bringing people out to the island because we are first and foremost there to protect the wildlife. However, it is public land. And so these tours, I think, are that balance, allowing access to a place without damaging the habitat or harassing the wildlife.
Matlock says the Centennial Tour was so successful that now her agency is considering leading small, supervised tours of St. Lazaria on an annual basis. She says the tours will give people a chance to witness the beauty and the fragility of the island.
I'm the optimist in the office who says that the more that people understand, the more respect they gain for a place by going to it, the more they feel like it is theirs, and they will want to protect it.
The summer sun is low in the sky, and the group gathers back at the water's edge to wait for the zodiac. Chuck Johnstone looks wistful. He says he's missed the island.
It's just different from anything else. The rocks are different, the shape, the texture of them.
He says this is likely the last time he'll be on St. Lazaria. It's getting hard to walk on the rugged terrain. But he says he's glad it's not easier to come here.
Well, it's nice that there's the inaccessibility that there is, because no matter how much they're impressed by it, and maybe even love it a little, if people overran it, it'd be gone.
On St. Lazaria Island, I'm Shalise Haas.
There it is. See, and there they're flying there. There they go.
At the mouth of the Kenai River, huge crowds have been dip net fishing. The season opened earlier this month with light turnout, but with nicer weather and reports of good salmon returns, the beach was busy this weekend, so much so that KDLL's Ben Stanton had trouble finding a place to park.
Finally, I find a spot near the Kenai Spur Highway, far from where the river meets Cook Inlet. The regular parking and overflow parking both are full. Luke Oliver works with the City of Kenai Park and Rec. He says if you're headed this way, patience is important.
We're just helping people, a little less chaos, helping them park, you know, that kind of thing to dip net, because the parking lot down on the beach is actually way too full for anyone to park at, so pretty crazy.
Groups of people wearing hip waders are rolling coolers and supplies, sometimes in sleds, down to the beach and through the sand to their spots. At the main entrance to the beach, one woman sets down her large net to speak with me.
I am Wanda King, and I'm from Anchorage. This is the second time I've been here, and last weekend was the first. We've gone to the Kasilof a few times, but I like it here better than I like it over at the Kasilof. It's not as slippery and slick. You don't have as much mud to deal with, so it's easier to get in and out. The fish are bigger, and you have a better chance of catching them.
King is looking for a place to start. There are open spots near where we stand, but up further into the mouth of the river, it is much more crowded. Many more discarded fish heads dot the sand, and the smell of fish is stronger. I walk up to a group that just brought in a couple sockeye salmon.
Emily Kewen and my daughter Carissa and my friend Judy Nettle were all from Anchorage, actually. Came down last night and overnighted and got here kind of early. Yeah. At 7:30, I guess, we got here this morning.
Kewen says it's been packed since then, and the fishing has been about average. She knows because Kewen's family has done this for quite a while.
About 20 years, I guess. Yeah, we call it the fish haul. It's our annual fish haul. And Chrissy's been learning to fillet ever since she was about 9 or whatever. So she has hack jobs. We've eaten a lot of hack jobs, but she's gotten to be better than I am now. So
Kewen and her daughter use an old ironing table with the cloth removed as a fillet table. The men and their group are in the water holding nets.
We have two big nets for a family of four, so we kind of share the running of them because you get tired and cold. But the guys never share this with us, do they, Chris?
No. No, we get the fun part.
Yeah, not nice.
Well, somebody's got to do it.
Somebody's got to do it, yeah. But we charge them, see, when they eat, yeah. They pay for their meals, yeah. No, they don't. I'm lying. It's great fun, anyway.
As we finish talking, we hear a cheer from people about 50 feet away. When I get there, a small group has gathered around a young man holding a big king salmon. Half a dozen people are taking pictures.
Joe Cohan. I'm actually from Juneau, and I'm playing on the Kenai, the Peninsula Oilers baseball team. My parents were up here, and so we figured we'd try out the fishing.
Cohan says he was not sure what he had at first.
Well, you know, I got it, and it was just real heavy, and I thought it was, you know, a couple of sockeye. I'd never caught two of them, and then got it up, and it started shining red, and, you know, figured it was a king.
He estimates it's between 50 and 60 pounds. Cohen got a lot of attention, and one man offered to let him use his fillet table. Cohen is a newcomer to dip net fishing and says there's not really any trick to it.
Hey, yesterday was my first time. Just stick the net in the water, and you'll get lucky. That's about it.
The north beach of the river has a new feature this year aimed at reducing erosion from so much foot traffic in one spot. Bob Freitas from the Kenai Parks and Rec Department says a permanent fence seems to be doing its job preserving the beach dunes. Dipnet fishing is open to Alaska residents only. At the Kenai River, I'm Ben Stanton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Bethel voters will have a chance to revoke the town's damp status in an upcoming election. 11 Bethel residents submitted a petition aimed at doing away with local option alcohol laws. Petition sponsors say that the state of Alaska has gone too far in trying to control local option communities. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
Currently under Bethel's local option, the city is damp. That means alcohol can be possessed and consumed, but it cannot be bought or sold. Bethel has been damp since 1977. Since that time, the state of Alaska has placed several restrictions on damp communities throughout the state. That includes monthly importation limits for individuals and visible labeling on any luggage that contains alcohol. 2 years ago, the legislature approved a set of changes to put customers from damp communities on a statewide database to track their alcohol purchases. Petition sponsors say the state's local option laws are too heavy-handed. Thomas Hawkins is a lead sponsor.
We actually do not think that the state is actually handling things in our best interest. So by opting out of local option, we, the citizens of Bethel, will control whatever happens when it comes to alcohol issues in our town.
Petition sponsors had no troubles collecting the necessary signatures. They collected 25% more valid signatures than they needed to get the measure put onto a ballot. The petition drive began this winter during the legislative session. At that time, Governor Sarah Palin's administration introduced Senate Bill 85. A part of that bill called for the monthly limits on beer and liquor to be cut in half. That was the last straw for many people growing weary of the state's local option laws. Bethel's representative Bob Heron said he received plenty of calls from angry constituents.
For someone outside our community, without talking to the legislators, without talking to the community, a few people, understandably, are a little miffed by that.
The importation restrictions were eventually pulled from that bill, but the petition process was already underway. It's been over 30 years since Bethel voters chose to prohibit the sale of alcohol within the community. Since that time, Bethel's local option status has been the subject of a dozen initiatives, but all of those failed. In the heart of Bethel lies the Tundra Women's Coalition. It's a shelter and outreach organization for victims of domestic abuse. Michelle DeWitt is TWC's director.
Ultimately, you know, it's up to the community if they want to be local option or not local option. So I understand and appreciate why this will continue to go back to the voters consistently.
TWC is coming off the highest service year in its history. Much of the abuse is fueled in part by alcohol. DeWitt says she's concerned about the consequences that could result if the town votes yes.
I think, you know, adding even more access to alcohol to the mix will strain our agency to an even greater degree, and I don't see our community being able to provide us extra supports to deal with that.
The Bethel City Council will now decide when the question will go before the voters. They could call for a special election, or they could put it on the next municipal election, which is scheduled for October. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Since opening 10 years ago, the Alaska Native Heritage Center has become well known as a primary visitor attraction. Less well known is that the center has also developed into one of Anchorage's most effective educational facilities. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
About 60 young Alaska Natives are working this summer at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. Ethan Pettigrew, Vice President of Cultural and Educational Services, says their presence counters a common misconception about the center.
We aren't a museum. Really, what we're about is transmitting culture, teaching culture to our youth, to our young people, and then secondarily to teach others about who we are as Native people.
A short walk from the main building to an Athabascan log cabin reveals that learning in action. Andrew Dementiff, whose family comes from Holy Cross, is explaining once common household items to a group of tourists.
This one, this is muskrat. They use this for their baby carriers.
Andrew is working at one of five outdoor sites, each one representing a particular Alaska Native group.
I've been working here for a couple weeks now. Very good experience. I've learned a lot, definitely a lot. Learned a lot about more about my culture. I came here to share my culture, and I came here with an open mind to learn more.
Pettigrew says immediate use of often newly gained knowledge is an underlying principle of the various year-round learning programs.
How we look at it here as a cultural center is we want our youth involved during winter time, and then again in the internship program we have here in the summer, we want them actively involved in learning aspects of their culture.
Inside the main building, opposite the Hall of Cultures, are work areas where young employees, like Emerson Thompson with family ties to St. Mary's and Mountain Village, are picking up hands-on skills.
Marge is just showing me how to do running stitch and some other stitches. After I learned this session of stitching, I move on to furs and make a coat and moccasins and mittens.
Marge is Marge Nakuk from St. Michael. And yes, the goal is for each student to make a full-size parka.
As you can see right over here, one of my students has made a wolf, wolverine, and sea otter ruff for around her parka. And when you turn it over, you see all her wonderful hand stitching here. And this was her first one she made. Isn't that awesome?
In an adjacent work area, Helen Koenig of Sitka guides students making tanned hide pre-contact style tunics. Pettigrew says student enthusiasm is matched by the teachers. He describes a conversation with one of the traditional artists.
She said to me, "This is by far the very best experience I've had. It feels so enriching. I've never had a better experience as far as teaching traditional clothing making. Your young people are so into it, and they're just eating up all the information and the knowledge, and they're doing a fantastic job on their clothing."
Similarly, Andrew Dementev eagerly anticipates future opportunities.
There's going to be an Athabascan dance group here starting here pretty soon. I'm going to try to get involved with that. I'm getting involved with NYO, Native Youth Olympics. I do the 1 foot high kick, 2 foot high kick, the Alaska high kick. I like the strength games better. That's from the Athabascan region.
What I'm laughing about, I chuckle about, is that they think they're out of school, but really they're not. They're in school, they're learning, they're being assessed. It's in a different format than typically traditional school systems do.
If the students don't consider their summer employment as educational, others have. Last year, the Alaska Native Heritage Center was one of 24 recipients of the President's National Coming Up Taller Award for Arts and Humanities Education. This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
And by
Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world. Guess who teens say is their most important influence when it comes to sex? Their parents. Listen up. Teens want to know what you think, even if they don't act like it. Talk with your teens about sex, love, and values. Nationwide, one out of every three girls gets pregnant at least once by age 20. Make sure your daughter isn't one of them. Visit stayteen.org for special parent tips and more information on how you can prevent teen pregnancy. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.